Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaitis, Judge Cochran, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Theodore Gaitis presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 29th, 2022, and we are holding this session via the Zoom platform. We have six cases on our calendar today. Three of those cases are scheduled for oral argument. And the attorneys are here for our first case. That case is A21-1051, State of Minnesota versus David Eugene Richardson Jr. And welcome to both lawyers in the case. I know that you're both familiar with the timing requirements for your arguments this morning. We do have a clock that should be visible to both of you on the screen that will be counting down 15 minutes for appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, and then a 5-minute rebuttal. Can you both see the clock? You can just nod your heads if you can. All right, I'm seeing two nods. Thank you. I would also note before we get started that we're making an audio recording of the arguments today, and that recording will be available on the court's website shortly. In the interest of having a good recording, I would just ask that you mute yourself when you're not talking, and also that you please introduce yourself and identify the party that you're representing at the outset of your arguments. And that ends my remarks. We will turn things over to Ms. Graff. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. My name is Leah Graff, and I represent the appellant, David Richardson. Following an error-ridden trial, Richardson asked this court to reverse his convictions and remand this case on several grounds. Respondent agrees that remand is required on one of these grounds, namely the erroneous admission of the complaining witness's prior out-of-court statements. Respondent's concession on this issue is correct, and this court should reverse and remand on this basis. Respondent has declined, however, to take any position regarding prongs 1 through 3 of Richardson's on the plain error test in connection with Richardson's remaining claims of unobjected to error, disputing only prong 4 of the analysis. Because questions raised by Richardson's other claims of error are likely to recur on remand, particularly when respondent has declined to address the plainness of multiple errors, Richardson asked this court to address Richardson's other claims and to reverse and remand on each of the grounds before this court. This morning, my intent is to focus on two of those grounds, the erroneous admission of court documents from a Wisconsin proceeding and prosecutorial misconduct. As to the Wisconsin court documents, while the error plainness and substantial rights analysis with respect to admission of those documents is rather clear, I want to briefly address those matters because I think that grappling with those issues provides important context when addressing the disputed fourth prong. Here we had a complaint that was admitted that included highly prejudicial material. Multiple charges were presented to the jury, including their felony level.
Ms. Graff, this is one of the unobjected to pieces, is that right?
Correct.
So if it were to be remanded, wouldn't that be the first part of this that could go differently, is that there could be an objection at that point or a motion in limine?
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think that because these issues are before this court now, and because we have no position from the state on this, and we know that these issues will come back up, it is appropriate for this court, as an error-correcting court, to address the claims of error that have been
presented. Well, I mean, if we agree with both you and the state, then it seems that the other issues might not be before us in the same way that they sometimes are, right? When that is the only issue or it's a contested issue. In that way, it's before us as an unobjected to error. But if we've decided the first issue, then it seems that the others might not be before us in that same way. So I guess I'm wondering whether we should reach that especially when there could be an objection the next time around. And it kind of makes me wonder if that would be more advisory. We don't do advisory opinions.
I think I understand your question, Your Honor. And of course, this court doesn't issue advisory opinions. This court does sometimes address even plain errors that have been raised on appeal to provide guidance on remand. The Supreme Court has done that, and this court has done that. So you're right. If this court agrees with the first sort of, I'll call it the first issue, which is the prior out-of-court statements of the complaining witness, and agrees with the respondent's concession, it can and should reverse and remand on that ground. It could stop there. Richardson's argument is that there were just a number of additional glaring errors that occurred here, and that it's appropriate for this court to speak on those to ensure that when there is a retrial of this matter, we have a fair trial and that we are not back here addressing the same or similar issue when it's been presented to the court. And that includes, you know, I think one issue that is the most likely to recur is these issues with these Wisconsin court documents. It's very clear that the state need only prove the existence of the Wisconsin proceeding and the complaining witnesses, in this case, her status as a potential witness in that other matter. The state could and did establish her status as a witness through her testimony, and could have established the existence of the Wisconsin proceedings with the case caption alone. Instead, again, this multiple count complaint, including all of the charges, their potential penalty, a domestic abuse charging modifier, all of that was presented to the jury without redaction. The jury was also presented with, I believe, a 5-page probable cause statement. That probable cause statement, the law is very clear, is inadmissible as testimonial hearsay. And in this case, it included just a flood of character evidence and prior bad act evidence. We also had the court admit an unredacted conditional release order in this case. The conditions included conditions that Mr. Richardson engage in no threats or not interfere with witnesses. This maps directly onto the charges at issue here when the specific conditions in that Wisconsin matter had no place whatsoever in this case. As to substantial rights, Richardson can tick every box in terms of what this court considers under that prong of the test. The documents were presented through a law enforcement officer's testimony, as well as through the court documents themselves, and the state referred to those documents in closing. When it comes to the fourth prong, refusal by this court to correct this error would cause the public to question the integrity of the court system. If a district court can sua sponte admit highly prejudicial and irrelevant evidence, appears to realize it during the course of trial, but fails to correct the error, and then through a last minute instruction, again on its own accord, actually exacerbates the error by highlighting the evidence for the jury and asking them to consider it, and this court were to refuse to address that error, the public would seriously question whether a defendant can receive a fair trial. A respondent has spent a portion of its brief addressing the fourth prong, but I believe that those arguments are unsupported by the case law. While I agree that the focus is not particular harm or personal prejudice to a particular defendant, this court still must consider the error in the context in which it occurred to determine whether this is the type of error that, if this court declines to correct, would sow broader doubt about the fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings. This is consistent with Straumann and consistent with the analysis that the Supreme Court undertook in Polzinski that respondent refers to. There was also an overwhelming amount of prosecutorial misconduct in this case. There are many instances outlined in the brief, and I would just highlight a couple of the most egregious ones this morning. Here, the prosecutor defined gaslighting and identified it as a classic domestic violence tactic in the course of closing argument. She used this to explain the complaining witness's testimony. This is very similar to State versus Peltier, where the prosecutor argued about the cycle of domestic abuse in the absence of any record evidence. Perhaps most problematic is the prosecutor's comment on Mr. Richardson's failure to testify. The prosecutor took defense counsel's argument on the law of that there be no adverse inference taken from his decision to not testify and weaponized it in her rebuttal. This was a direct comment on Mr. Richardson's failure to testify. It was the last thing that the jury heard, and it was a glaring violation of Fifth Amendment principles. The prosecutor also used in multiple ways and sometimes sort of simultaneously other very improper tactics by aligning herself with the jury, invoking broader concerns about the nature and issues with domestic violence and their and prosecution of domestic violence events, and also asking the jury to send a message to the victim by saying multiple times that the jury needed to show up for her. These are all tactics that this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly disapproved of. The state cannot show that the misconduct did not affect Richardson's substantial rights and hasn't even argued a lack of impact here. Again, the theme of the closing was rooted in these multiple forms of misconduct. As to the fourth prong, a refusal by this court to correct the error will cause the public to question the fairness and integrity of the judicial process. If a prosecutor can rely on wholly improper means to persuade a jury in closing, and when those illegitimate means are really targeted to the weaknesses of the state's case, and then the state does nothing to explain or justify that conduct on appeal, and this court were still to refuse to address that conduct, again, that would breed doubt about the fairness of the process. The public would rightly question the integrity of criminal trials, and it runs the risk that prosecutorial misconduct will simply be viewed as an acceptable cost of doing business.
Counsel, can you, with regard to either the Wisconsin documents or the alleged prosecutorial misconduct, can you point us to any precedential opinion analyzing that fourth prong in a similar factual situation and concluding that that was met, that the fairness and integrity of the judicial system, you know, the would be questioned if there wasn't a reversal based on the alleged errors?
So I would point the court to Strawman in terms of Strawman reaching both questions of substantial rights, and then as to the fourth prong, referring sort of to the overall fairness of the defendant's trial. The obvious implication there is that given that the nature and context of the error, the unfairness of the trial, if we let this be, we will cause the public to question the integrity of the judicial process. It was evidentiary error in that case as well. In terms of, I think, a more detailed look at the context and what I'm asking the court to undertake here is Polzinski. And, you know, there the court sort of says, even if we assume prongs 1 through 3, let's look at when and how this happened. And that is the way the court reasons through that fourth prong. I think respondent's position sort of would leave the court with sort of a mythical or insurmountable prong 4, and that's really not consistent with the case law. And in fact, in Rosales-Morales, the United States Supreme Court rejected a lower court's very high bar for that fourth prong and sort of said this should be for a broader scope of reversal, or permit a broader scope of reversal than the Fifth Circuit in that case allowed. So the fourth prong analysis that Richardson puts before this court is consistent with all of those cases.
Thank you.
And if the court doesn't have any further questions, I will just respond in rebuttal.
I'm not seeing any additional questions. Thank you for your arguments. Next, we will hear from Mr. Smith. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. As appellant, as counsel for appellant correctly notes, the state concedes that appellant is entitled to a new trial based on the erroneous admission of the victim's out-of-court statements. And on that grounds alone, this court should remand this matter for a new trial. Given that concession, it is absolutely unnecessary for this court to reach the appellant's claims of unobjected to error. Those errors are not preserved for appellate review. The review of plain error is a discretionary review, and it's a limited discretionary review. And the Minnesota—
Mr. Smith, if I can jump in, because do you disagree that this court has done that very thing in the past?
I think it has. This court certainly has rarely done so. And generally, when this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court has done so to consider issues to give guidance, they've mostly been related to issues of jury instructions. That was one of the issues in Strauman that they addressed, was the failure to give, I think it was an accomplice liability jury instruction. And that is certainly helpful. But as you noted in your question to appellant's counsel, these issues, if they do recur, are unlikely to recur in the same way. These issues have been identified and flagged now that there's been a trial and they've been claimed as plain error. And there can be motions to allow the district court in the first instance to do a full and adequate analysis about these issues and address them.
Mr. Smith, I am struggling a little bit with that approach. I certainly understand that, you know, the district court didn't have an opportunity to correct these errors, arguably, because there was no objection. And yet, I mean, these are the kind of errors that these define plain errors. I mean, these are really significant errors that shouldn't happen the first time around. And so I'm a little concerned about just sort of leaving it and trusting that the process will work the next time around. And I'm just hoping you can sort of help me balance that concern with the concern that you're talking about, that and the concern that Judge Bryan identified about issuing something akin to an advisory decision on those additional errors.
Well, I certainly agree with Judge Bryan's point that essentially that would be an advisory opinion on those additional errors. At the very best, they would constitute dicta, because they would not be necessary to the ultimate decision of the case. Because the first issue, the objected to error, is dispositive of the case. And I think that is a real concern. I certainly, you know, understand the concern. Well, maybe the trial court still won't get this right. But I think that turns the presumption that everyone, including the district court judge and defense counsel, are going to do their jobs and act in accordance with law on its head, and seems highly improbable in light of this case, Mr. Smith, the entire process.
I think that makes some sense. But at the same time, if you're talking about an error, I'll use Ms. Graff's words, as glaring as these errors may be, I'm not sure that I have that same faith that if presented without some comment from this court, if presented on a retrial, that they won't occur again.
You know, and I guess beyond what I've already said, I'm not sure if this court is that skeptical about the district court judge's ability to do his job on remand, then I'm not sure what I can possibly say that will allay this court's concerns. But at the same point in time, this court having concerns about that doesn't justify the deciding of issues that are unnecessary to the decision of the case. That's a fundamental principle of judicial restraint. And I think it's particularly important when we're talking about plain error, unobjected to error. If these errors really are that plain, as glaring as appellant contends they are, And I don't concede they are. I simply made no argument. Appellant has the burden of demonstrating those prongs of the test. Then the district court shouldn't need guidance after the case has been reversed. Because that's what we're saying when we say something is plain error, is that no one needs guidance. You didn't need anyone to bring this to your attention. So if that really is the case, if those errors are really that glaring, I'm not sure what further guidance this court could do. I'm not entirely sure whether given the questions about advisory opinions and dicta, whether those questions would even be law of the case. I haven't thought deeply about that, but I certainly have concerns about this. And this court routinely declines to consider alternative assignments of error once it has concluded that a particular error is sufficient to merit a new trial in a criminal case. And this isn't a case that justifies, especially with the issues raised about the fourth prong of the plain error test, this isn't a case that merits this court wading into that territory, because essentially the fourth prong of the plain error test is a threshold issue. And I maintain, despite appellant's protestations to the contrary, that appellant has waived the arguments he's now making about the fourth prong. Those arguments were not raised in the principal brief. The arguments raised in the principal brief applied an essentially different standard for the fourth prong that conflates the third prong and the fourth prong, and just argues that because the appellant didn't receive a fair trial, that is, because the error affected his substantial rights, those are the same question, that those errors affected the fairness and integrity of the judicial proceedings. Appellant's principal brief repeatedly uses the phrase "the judicial proceedings." That's not the standard. The standard is whether the errors call into question the fairness, integrity, and reputation of the judicial system writ large, generally. And the Supreme Court has made that abundantly clear. I do want to address appellant's point that I'm arguing for a standard that was essentially rejected by the United States Supreme Court in Rosales-Mireles. I'm not arguing that. They were dealing with something akin to a shocks the conscience standard there. That's not what I'm arguing for. What I'm saying, first and foremost, is that appellant has waived an argument that actually applies the correct standard, because that argument wasn't made in the principal brief. And that even now, the arguments are essentially slightly shifted, but more or less the same. They're basically assertions that these errors affect the substantial, that seriously raise a question about the fairness and integrity of the judicial system generally. And those, there aren't specific reasons pointed to for why that's the case. The citation to Straumann, I think, is ultimately unavailing. The analysis in Straumann of the fourth prong is paltry. The Supreme Court during that time period wasn't doing a substantial analysis of the fourth prong. It's become abundantly clear in the time since Straumann was issued that the fourth prong is much more robust and is much more important to a plain error analysis. And for that reason, I think that counsels against considering these unobjected to errors when the objected to preserved error is sufficient to grant a new trial. And if the members of the panel have no further questions, I have nothing to add and would simply ask the court to remand for a new trial based on the error in admitting the victim's out-of-court statements, and decline to address the other issues. Thank you.
Judge Counsel, did you have a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I understand your argument on the fourth prong, but it seems to me appellant did make an argument on the fourth prong, and you're just arguing your view is that argument doesn't meet the standard, not so. The argument really isn't waived, I don't think.
Well, I would submit that for the most part, the reference that the pages that the counsel for appellant has identified in the reply brief as locations where appellant made a fourth prong argument, those places are actually unsupported assertions. There's no set of premises leading to a conclusion. There's more or less a one or two sentence assertion that this particular error affects the integrity and fairness of the judicial proceedings. And the standard didn't change with Polzinski. The standard has always been that it has to be the fairness, integrity, and reputation of judicial proceedings generally.
Thank you for that response.
Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Smith. We will go back to Ms. Graff. If you have any rebuttal, you may proceed. And Ms. Graff, you're mute still.
Thank you so much. Sorry about that. I will start with sort of where the court left off with respondents' counsel as to the fourth prong. This was addressed in the reply, but the fourth prong issue was not waived by Richardson. It was addressed. Respondent just disagrees with the argument that has been made, but that does not lead to waiver. Even respondents' own cases arguing for waiver don't support its position that Richardson waived that issue here. If the standard didn't change in Polzinski, I agree with that, then that means Polzinski didn't overrule Straumann. And the Supreme Court in Rosales-Morales talks about this is a standard that looks at, is rooted in fairness. That's what the Straumann court is looking at. There is a question of overall fairness that should be considered by this court because there is no way for a defendant to satisfy the fourth prong in the context of a question of whether others, the public generally, or the fairness of proceedings generally will be questioned without some underlying unfairness in the case. I struggle to understand what respondent believes that fourth prong inquiry looks like if it's not what Richardson has advanced here, and if it's not what the court did in Polzinski, which was to look at what happened and to say, in this context, we're not so concerned. So for all of those reasons, I don't think that this court would need to break any new ground or wander into any sort of newly generated traffic on the fourth prong. In terms of reaching that prong and whether this court should do so, respondent talked about, if these errors are so plain, then nobody should need to be, we can just say these are plain error. But that, again, involves this court saying in this proceeding, this was plain error. Just because the errors are plain doesn't mean this court doesn't need to speak on them. I mean, it does so with great frequency. In terms of, this court addressing alternative assignments of error only when it's jury instructions or usually when it's jury instructions, it also happens with additional evidentiary errors because those are the type that are also likely to recur. And we have those present in this case. That includes one case where the alternative assignment of error was a plain error issue involving the admission of evidence, and that's State versus Youn, Y-O-E-U-N, 2013, Westlaw, 619-6553. And that's just an example of this court providing guidance on remand. In summary, Richard's convictions must be reversed. Nobody disagrees on that point. This court should reverse and remand on the prior statements issue on which the parties do agree, but in the interest of avoiding another unfair and error-ridden trial and to ensure the integrity of the judicial process, this court should also reverse and remand on the other grounds raised in Richardson's brief. And I would rest on that if there are no further questions from the court.
Thank you very much for both of your arguments this morning. The case is now-